WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome to another Monday Night Talk. We are coming to you live from the Kingston Council on Aging, and we have a lively group here. Everybody, just so you don't think that we do not have a captive audience, they are here. We have a great lineup, and we had a little bit of a celebration before the start of the show for Tammy Murray, who is the former Council on Aging Director on Elder Affairs, and She is going to be leaving. Oh, no. Oh, all right, there we go. She is going to be my co-host, as is Gretchen Emmett. She is going to be the interim director. Gretchen, say hi.
Hi, everybody.
She's good, isn't she?
She is.
We have a great show lined up for you. We start things off with a little conversation with Tammy and Gretchen, kind of get an idea as to what is going to be happening in regards to the changeover. Tammy, of course, going to be moving up the way to Hanover. Is that correct, Tammy?
Yep, I actually did already. I started a week ago, so I'm the Director of Elder Services in Hanover. And Gretchen, as the Assistant Director, will be the Interim Director until Kingston hires somebody else.
Gretchen, give me your thoughts on tonight's program. You looking forward to this?
I am, and I actually, I'm so excited about the guests that we have tonight and the Hoarding Task Force from Old Colony Services. I think it's something that really needs to be addressed, and it's certainly coming to the forefront, even with more training for people. So I'm really looking forward to what they have to say for it.
So we have Dina Andrade. Did I say that right, Dina?
Yes.
And we have Teresa, or is it Terry? Either or. Courts, so they're experts on hoarding and clearing out your clutter. And I think we're all a little guilty of that. Larry, are you guilty of that?
I got a lot of stuff.
Okay, Larry's got a lot of stuff. I'm a little bit, if you ask my significant other, she will tell you I am also guilty of it. We're going to get to the bottom of it. Why do we hoard? Why do we collect things? Is it just we're trying to hold on to something? Is it some kind of instability in our past that we're trying to get a grasp on? Can medication cure it? All kinds of things. We'll talk about that with Dina and Teresa. Then we have a book author, and I think this gentleman was here previously, Casey Sherman. Anybody here last time Casey was here? No? Okay. Well, then, good. Then I'm sorry.
Marilyn
was here, of course. Casey's going to be here. He's an award-winning journalist and best-selling author, and he's got a couple of books in the works. He's got one on the Ice Bucket Challenge. Let's not forget, he also was a co-author in regards to the Boston Strong movie that was turned into a movie, right? So... Yeah, not too much, because we want to give him a little bit when he does show up here, so just to make him feel warm. And then Brian Stratton, a musician, producer, promoter, and he's also a WATD talk show host that you can hear Wednesdays and Thursdays at 9 o'clock, Friends with Benefits. But he's here to kind of talk a little bit about his work on an album that he's actually going to be donating proceeds to ALS. It's kind of interesting that both Casey Sherman, who wrote the book about Pete Frates and ALS. That's kind of going to be like a common theme for that hour. So we're looking forward to it. And Brian, we've actually asked Brian to maybe sing a couple of songs for us from his new album, where he's actually got all kinds of musician friends that you probably would know right off the top. Jeffrey Gaines, Paula Cole, and I even think Darius Rucker had something to do with it. So Hootie and the Blowfish, anybody know? Yeah, okay, so Brian will be here. We'll even chat a little bit about Scituate Heritage Days, which are actually coming up. Anything you ladies want to say in regards to some of our guests?
I'm excited for it. I love music, as you know.
Yes.
And I think it's great to bring music out to everyone. I've been to a lot of concerts lately for older bands, and I noticed that a lot of the people there were over 60. So I think it's really something that's going to be moving forward in our councils on aging.
Okay. And hopefully everybody will stick around for that and hear the stories. And again, we'll speak with After Traffic. We'll check in with Tammy and Gretchen and kind of get an idea as to what direction the Kingston Council on Aging will be moving in the direction of. I will let folks know that if any of our guests, you have a question, please feel free to write it down. I think Marilyn is actually walking around with papers. Do you have a question for Teresa or Dina or Casey or Brian? Please feel free. Marilyn will have the paper and we'll read the question.
I'm excited. Are you excited? The Massachusetts legislature has proposed virtually to double the current tobacco tax. Seriously, $900 million the Commonwealth receives from tobacco tax revenue every year. I hope weed sells this good, because if the proposed taxes are passed, we're changing the name of our business. How's Brennan's in New Hampshire sound? Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's in New Hampshire. Come buy your tobacco here, tax-free, while stocking up on your booze and fireworks. Literally stealing tax dollars from the hardworking families in Massachusetts. The truth is, the legislature depends on tobacco taxes to balance the budget in Massachusetts every legislative session. So put that in your pipe. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, and coming soon to New Hampshire.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we are back here live at the Kingston Council on Aging. And this is probably a bittersweet day because Tammy Murray, who is the outgoing Council on Aging. Actually, she's already gone. You just don't know it, but she is here. She's moved on to Hanover, but we also have Gretchen Emmets. She's the interim director. Just kind of get an idea as to, you know, the importance of Council on Aging and some of the stuff that you offer here. There's many times that I've had a chance to visit and find out, you know, what's going on in regards to doing a radio program from here. And there's always, it's like a beehive of activity. How important is a Council on Aging, no matter where it is on the South Shore?
I think it's really important for people to feel that they have somewhere to go. I know even councils that are not as busy as we are here, there's always somewhere where someone can go. I met a woman actually in Hanover the other day who had lost a son. And in the afternoon, it kind of hits her on certain days. So she just comes and reads the paper in the library. You know, and she goes to other bereavement courses and such that they offer there. But just to have somewhere that you can go and feel comfortable and have interactions with people your own age. A funny story, I had my mom start teaching a knitting class here, and she really started to make a lot of friendships. And my daughter turned around one day and said, it's great that grandma has friends her own age, because she was helping me raise my kids while I worked, so she was always hanging out with people my age. So it was interesting.
It is definitely an interesting you know, concept that we have somewhere that, you know, you have something for the youth when it comes to sports and different activities. I think there should be activities for folks of all ages. And I feel that the Council on Aging, there's all kinds of things that's going on. I've come in and there's been people doing yoga. You've had authors that have come in.
Absolutely.
Different types of entertainment. Gretchen, give me your thoughts. I mean, you are the interim at this particular time, which means you're kind of taking that spirit stick and running.
And we really are. And it's a, this is a place for all ages. And I think a lot of our programs continuing in the fall are intergenerational programs. We do a lot with the grandparents and the grandchildren. We went to the Museum of Science one day. We had a full busload in for the day. And I think it's really important that the two intermingle. It's the kids learn a lot from their grandparents and from the seniors, and they have a lot of fun, and it brings a lot of smiles to the seniors' faces to have the younger generation in here. And let me tell you something, my seniors can kick their butts doing Zumba, the high schoolers.
It's true.
So,
which is definitely unique. Now, what are you going to miss about Kingston and the community that you've become a part of here as the COA, director of Elder Affairs?
Well, I live in Kingston, so it's very close to my heart. I think I will miss the Zumba and the women who can not sweat much longer than I can. All the times I wanted to quit and I look up and somebody 74 years old is jumping around, you know, it kind of makes you feel silly. But I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss the friendships that I've made. It's just been a wonderful experience. It's not easy to leave, but it's something that's better for me, so I have to do what's best. But I look forward to making similar contacts in Hanover.
And it was through you and Marilyn that this is our third visit here to the Kingston Council, and we thank you, WAT thanks the folks for welcoming us in and letting us do radio programs from here to better inform the residents, not only the ones that are in front of us, but the folks who are listening at home, and get an idea as to what happens at a council on aging. Do you feel that you've left Kingston, the Council on Aging, in a better position since you started?
Absolutely. The night events alone, it was a big false statement that seniors won't drive at night or come out in the winter or interested in authors. You know, some things it was like throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what would stick, but we've been able to do that and build a great community. We're open steadily two nights a week right now. It was three. And they can still do that by appointment. But we're really looking forward to the author series coming up in the fall. And I know a lot of other centers are going to start having night hours as well.
Now, Gretchen, what do you do to take the lead from Tammy? Or, you know what, starting your own direction to make it better, even better than it is now?
Well, that's interesting because Tammy's done a lot in the past few years that she's been here. But we have right now going on two different programs in the end of the hallway. And then we have a third coming in tonight. So it's an active center. We just need to keep it active. We need to have Marilyn keep working on those authors to bring in people or famous musicians. That could be one, too. And we just need to get the word out that we're open, that we're available. A lot of our functions are free, which is amazing. Mm. And I think that is part of the goal of the center over the next few years is to have all our exercise classes given for free. That would be great. But it's just like on a Friday afternoon when the women are playing dice in the grand room, I'm in the office and you just hear him laughing because someone won the pot. And it's like almost like a playground, hearing the laughter from the playground. And, you know, it's starting from 95 to like 65 years old. And it's just, it's very heartwarming. And I think more people should know exactly what's out here for them.
What's some of the ways that you will look to continue or maybe improve on reaching out to get folks to come in? Because so many more avenues that are at your disposal over the past 20 years, especially with social media, but yet you still can use email blast, and even the conventional sending a letter is still a form of communicating as well.
It is. We have the newsletter. We do do the social media, but it's amazing because it's still, people don't realize. They just are still not. Someone said to me, "Oh, you have a yoga class here?" Yeah, for the past 2 years. So they just don't know. But I think that, you know, it may be they weren't ready to say that they were a senior. I don't know. That I can't go there. So if you can spread the word, a lot of it is word of mouth. And I think that if you spread the word, it will start to to get out a little bit better.
And we want to, Monday Night Talk wants to thank, and 95.9 WATD wants to thank Kingston Council on Aging for inviting us back to, again, do radio programs like this. We've had some great guests who have who've come in, and we're going to have, again, mm-hmm. more great guests this evening as kind of a celebration of the changing of the guard, so to speak. So what we are going to do is we're going to step aside for just a couple of moments. When we come back, we're going to talk a little hoarding. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome opening day, Pembroke Titans softball.
Okay, Addie, you got this. Just relax.
I know, Dad.
First batter coming to the plate.
I know, Hattie, but just keep your eye on the ball. Just keep your eye on the ball.
Dad, relax. I do got this.
I know, Hattie. Remember, don't swing at the first pitch.
Daddy!
And here's the pitch. That is a fair... In fact, that's a home run!
Sorry about your windshield, Dad.
Are you kidding me? That was awesome. I'm keeping the inspection sticker for a souvenir.
Windshield broken by a home run? Call Tiny first. 1-888-64-TINYS.
That's my Hattie.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
We are back here at the Kingston Council on Aging, and we are joined by Dina Andrade.
Yes.
And Terry Quartz.
Yes.
Experts in the area of hoarding. Now, just for a show of hands, and folks at home can't see this, which is kind of crazy because radio is not a visual medium. Let's see by a show of hands, anybody here wants to admit to being a hoarder? Anybody? 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 How about in the back there? Nobody? Okay. All right. Yeah, me too. I got my hand up too. I'm not ashamed of it.
Put it up.
All right, there you
my
go.
My mother's back there going, put
yes,
your hand up.
Yes. And my girlfriend Sandy at home is putting her hand up as well, saying, oh, yeah, there's a way for me to have him get rid of half the stuff he has. I guess, I'm telling you. Ladies, let me ask you, I don't know if you guys would have the same definition. What would you give as a definition for compulsive hoarding?
Compulsive hoarding has to include three things, a person who collects, a person who keeps the items, you know, in terms of the items interfering with their day-to-day functioning, the items can cause distress in their day-to-day activities. So it's having a connection to the items and not being able to let go of them, which causes the issue with their stuff.
Okay. Well, what are some of the behaviors associated with hoarding? Is it just a matter of just piling up stuff in concise order? Or, I mean, because everybody has seen or heard about the TV show that they had. And it's not something that's not far-fetched when we talk about... sometimes it can be life-threatening.
Yes.
Depending on what it's like. And I've jokingly put my hand up saying, I'm a hoarder. My dad is just as bad. I go to my dad's house and he has stuff that's piled up. That's just how he is.
Right.
And sometimes I worry because I don't know if there's going to be, some of the stuff is wet, is there going to be fungus? So I guess, again, I mean, what are some of the behaviors associated with hoarding?
Well, it can cause issues with infestation, like you mentioned. It can cause, you know, problems with ambulation in terms of trying to ambulate within their own environment. It can cause fire safety concerns if an EMT needs to get in there and help with a stretcher to get out. It can also cause, you know, avalanches or even, you know, if it's a second floor, the ceiling could cave in.
Right.
You know, so those are the extreme. But, you know, a person can collect items and have it be in an orderly fashion. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have issues with hoarding. It can be somebody that has a connection with them and that doesn't want to let go of those items, which causes the functional issue. Does that make sense?
It does. Okay. Tammy? Don't let me have all this fun.
Every time I talk about hoarding, I think of my house and my closet. But And then my grandmother and all her shoes that were piled up neatly in boxes, mm-hmm. but she had a million pairs of shoes.
Right.
And she loved her shoes. So just on that note, what kind of things do people hoard?
They can. It's amazing the different things people can hoard. I've seen, you know, home-delivered meals containers to newspapers to, like you mentioned, shoes. It can run the gamut. It depends on what the person happens to like, you know. It can be something that's small and shiny, you know, matchboxes. It can, you know,
I
coins.
Remember from Jesse's training at yep. Metropolitan Boston Housing mm-hmm. Partnership, he was talking about a gentleman who saved the caps of toothpaste yep. to paint or to plant seeds in, and he right. just had tons of them. So
right.
even things like that are
yep.
amazing.
If you will, I know we did have a couple of questions here. Read one of the questions, if you will.
Okay, the first question is from Nancy from Kingston.
And Nancy, are you here?
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
When you're moving, where do you start if you have a house full of stuff or an apartment full of stuff?
I can start and address that. One of the consumers that I've worked with, she said to me one day, I'm looking at my situation right now of what I want to take with me. So I think that's a good place to start. If there is an overwhelming amount of belongings that you have, you can think about it in the way of, what do I need to take with me? What do I want to take with me? And then go from there.
All right, here's my question, because I think we need to separate one mm-hmm. from the other.
Yep.
Is there a difference between hoarding and being a pack rat? Is there a difference?
I would say yes. I mean,
how so?
Somebody that collects items, it can be in an organized fashion, and it can be out for display, and it can be in a nice, neat, you know, shelving unit. But somebody who has issues with hoarding, it is, like I said, impeding their ability to function on a day-to-day basis and possibly putting them at risk. So that's what I see as the difference. You can be a collector, and you can, you know, collect things because they bring you joy, and they can be in an organized fashion in your home, but it's not impeding your overall functioning level.
Okay. Because we have had friendly conversations. From time to time, we hear the managing news editor, Christine James, talk about how she has things all mm-hmm. piled up. I don't know if she professes to being someone who hoards or somebody who is a pack rat, but she does like to collect and pile things up.
I mean, you can have clutter, but as long as you don't have like an attachment to it and you're okay with throwing it out and going through it and expunging certain things, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have hoarding issues.
Okay, that's definitely interesting.
Or you can just be messy.
Yeah.
Or lazy.
Yeah.
You know, you don't
yeah.
feel like throwing stuff out so it piles
right.
up.
Right.
Which would probably right. lead to squalor, but...
Right. And sometimes squalor, you know, can be because someone becomes physically disabled and they're not able to clean out, like you mentioned. But they don't necessarily have an attachment with some of the items.
Right.
So I guess I would ask is compulsive hoarding, is it something that's caused that someone has deprived or deprivation? Is it a form of that?
There's been a lot of studies on compulsive hoarding, and sometimes it's linked to other disorders. Most often it's linked to other disorders. You know, that could be depression, it could be ADD, it could be any other mental health issue. It's often runs concurrently. And the research that we know of basically says that sometimes people who have hoarding issues, it might have started due to some type of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And it can run the gamut in terms of age, socioeconomic. It doesn't discriminate. So anybody could have hoarding issues.
What's some of the cases that you two ladies have come across, mm-hmm. and what's some of the methods that you've had to utilize in order to get someone to realize that they need to eliminate some of their clutter, not only for health purposes, but mm-hmm. also for, you know, to be able to be ambulant around their own house?
It's a long-term process, and Dina can speak to this individually, I mean directly, because she's worked with individuals that have had hoarding issues, but it is a long process to work with somebody one-on-one in terms of trying to assist them with sorting and discarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've worked with several consumers, and each of them have hoarding or excessive cluttering issues, and there's not just one, you know, general way that it's happening. Everybody deals with it in a different manner. What I like to do is I like to see the person as the person and not their belongings. I use a strength-based approach, which helps the consumer identify maybe possibly why they are hoarding and what the challenges are in getting, you know, discarding the items. And we go from there. We make a detailed plan of care and try to gather all the resources in the community to see how we can support the individual. And I think it's really important for us to recognize that, you know, just because someone hoards doesn't mean that they're not a person. We need to really take a look at this person and support them in their decisions and help them through the process of, you know, maybe stopping the excessive acquiring or help them with ways that they can discard the items in the home. There's several reasons why, you know, people have these issues. The excessive acquiring could be from, someone having a bad day and doing some retail therapy. They get in that euphoric effect. And it could be that they're doing that from avoiding, you know, some type of emotional, you know, turbulence in their life. I had one consumer whose mother had passed away, and she had gathered all the mother's belongings in her small one-bedroom apartment and avoided dealing with the loss of her mother. So all that stuff stayed there, and it put her tenancy at risk in the housing authority. And her and I were able to, you know, work together and figure out why she was trying to avoid, you know, not processing the stuff that she had in her home. And when she was able to figure out, is she was avoiding all the pain from associated with the loss from her mother. Yep.
Okay, and then, of course, that's Dina Andrade, and we have Terry Kortz, experts when it comes to hoarding and clutter. I guess my argument with, when it comes to a solution, myself and another sibling have discussed the best way to help my dad to be able to clean it out. And while I have one sibling who wants to take the tough love approach, you just go in and clean it out, I'm like going, I don't know if you can do that. That could cause psychological damage. Mm-hmm. What's the right way? Do you do the tough love approach and clean it out, or do you find a clever way, a long-term way, like you're saying?
No.
No tough love.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have found out the hard way that when family members or organizations go in and do a forced cleanup, it can be detrimental to the consumer. It can throw the consumer into a tailspin in terms of their emotional, connection to their items, and it actually has caused, you know, a really negative effect on some consumers where they can become suicidal. So you really have to be careful with the forced cleanup. We would not recommend it, and it doesn't happen as swiftly as it does on TV. It is a process, and the person has to be involved in that process in order to make decisions about what they keep and what they discard. And if they're not involved in that process, then they're not really buying into the plan. And we've learned the hard way, you know, for years and years prior to all the research that came out on hoarding in terms of protective services, where we would go in and we said, oh, this person needs a, you know, heavy chore and needs a heavy, you know, a cleanup. Let's go in, do it. And then less than 6 months later, we were in a worse situation in terms of the items piling back up and placing them at risk again. So we've learned the hard way, unfortunately. But as the research develops and teaches us and educates us, we're trying to educate other people with the task force that, you know, that's not the quick fix.
Okay. I believe we have another question from a member of the audience,
yep,
if
Mary
you will.
Mary Jane is also from Kingston. How do you know what to throw out or what to recycle?
I can answer that one. One of the techniques that I use with my consumers that allows them to stay in charge is that we make rules for discarding items. One of the general rules, and it does change per person, is that anything that is broken, soiled, can't be used for the intended purpose would automatically be thrown out. Something that could be recycled depends on the city that you live in, what they accept, bottles, cans, and so forth. They could also donate items to their favorite charity. And sometimes those things make it easier because we're coming up with these rules for discarding when they don't have the items in front of them, so it takes the emotional attachment away from them. We often provide a list of their rules, so when they are going through the discarding process, they just easily look at those rules and say, you know what, I said that this is what I'm going to do. These are my rules, and they have an easier, it's easier for them to follow the rules once they're already established rather than looking at the item and saying, well, what am I going to do with this? So I think it's really important to establish those rules ahead of time to help the individuals make that decision.
How often do you find yourselves being updated in regards to what to do when handling hoarding situations, going to seminars, to at least keep yourselves educated on the latest methods to be able to help somebody, you know, separate from the things that they have collected so lovingly over years and years and years?
Well, one of the things that the Greater Brockton Area Hoarding Task Force is, we're members of the steering committee, which is run by Mass Housing, which runs, you know, couple times a year meetings for all the task forces, the chairpeople of the task forces, to give us the updated research. And the people that are doing the research, you know, BU and Randy Frost, the key researchers, Gail Steckety, they're on that task force, the steering committee, to give us that information firsthand in terms of bringing that back to the communities to educate what's going on in terms of the updated research.
How about treatment? Is there a treatment other than helping somebody get to release these items so that you can sort through them? Is there a particular treatment, whether it's them seeing a doctor and sitting down and talking about the problems, or how about medications? Is there one or the other?
No. I mean, the treatment that we're aware of is that you have to really work on the underlying mental health issue. And depending on what that mental health issue is, you know, they recommend the cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, in my experience and what I know, and Dina can also answer this as well, is that they don't know of any specific medication to treat hoarding disorder. It just is medication that will treat other mental health issues. You know, like we were talking about this before we went live in terms of anxiety, you know, depression. Right. Those kind of things where there are medications that can treat those disorders. Mm-hmm. Do you want to add anything, Dina?
I often use the Buried and Treasures framework with my consumers, which is based off cognitive behavioral therapy, which allows the person to think about their behaviors in a different way and really, you know, go through the emotions and so forth. But again, with like Terry said, there is no definite medication to treat hoarding as of the last study that I did read. And they just basically treat the symptoms or the comorbidity that goes along with it.
Tammy, do you have a question?
Not so much a question. I wanted to go back to what Dina was talking about with not judging the person on their disorder. And it's something that we learned in the class that I took, was it's a person with hoarding, so kind of step away from calling people hoarders.
Correct.
Or all that kind of stuff, because it does kind of clump everybody together, and one person may have a totally different reason
than
another.
I'm a pack rat personally. Just saying.
Right.
As you were saying, continue.
Yeah, no, and I'm always busy, so there's always junk somewhere in my house. I think I sleep with half my wardrobe on my bed. So it's like when you look at the pictures that they use as tools, and it shows the clutter spectrum and like where it's okay and where it's a problem and where in the middle you might be able to help someone. I think those tools are really important for towns even to start using. Do you guys get those out too? I know that, you know, Gretchen from here goes to your task force, and I'll be attending for Hanover, but do you have other towns where you pass out that kind of information, or is that something they get on their own?
You know, when we get requests for information, we are certainly sharing that information mm-hmm. with people. You know, the clutter image scale, you know, we're sharing the universal inspection checklist, yeah. which was developed. We are, you know, talking to people when they're asking about hoarding, you know, about language. You mentioned language is key. Let them define what their items are. And go with it in terms of that. Don't call them their stuff trash. Don't call it junk. Let them define it, which is really important. And I know that Dina also, you know, she mentioned the strength-based, you know, approach. She also uses the harm reduction approach, which has taught us a lot over time in terms of what's the least amount that's going to do the least amount of damage in terms of the environment that can be done. Mm-hmm. So your question, the answer, yes, we do send that information out. Have we sent it out globally? Usually it comes per request, per
yeah.
town,
yeah.
Per person. You know, it usually comes to us because somebody knows somebody that has some hoarding issues.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great tool that would make mm-hmm. us all be on the same playing field, mm-hmm. you know, both at Councils on Aging yep. or, you know, one of the things that we ran into is someone went on a home visit and came back and they're like, this person has hoarding issues. And I'm like, do they really have hoarding issues or are you a neat freak? And yeah. they had a little yeah. bit of junk on, right. in the hallway. Right. You know
exactly.
what I mean? So
because everybody has a different
tools.
Perception.
Exactly. Yeah.
Everybody has a different perception. Mm-hmm. And again, nobody can, I personally feel nobody can judge us except a man above,
mm-hmm. yeah.
personally. But mm-hmm. you know what? We all, you know. Yeah. Everybody has a different point of view, and I definitely respect that. And again, you are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. We are talking a little bit about hoarding, and we got two great experts here in Dina and Terry, who are experts on hoarding and clearing out the clutter. I think I wanted to ask you, and you mentioned it earlier about, you know, everybody has seen the TV show and how extreme it mm-hmm. is. Do you find yourself watching it and sometimes going, and kind of questioning their methods or how they're putting the perception out there? Because a lot of people, when we watch what mm-hmm. we see on TV, sometimes people take it as, you know, it's gospel. That's what's actually, you know, you should do this. Mm-hmm. Like my question to you about the tough love mm-hmm. that I have a sibling asking. I mean, give me your thoughts on a TV show and some of the ways that they try to edit it for. You know, to glamorize it or to kind of...
I think that's more it. I think that, you know, it is depicted that way to get the audience to watch it. Mm-hmm. Do I think that that's how it really plays out in real life? No. I think that sometimes if you show people that it's going to be a quick fix and it's not, you're going to do more harm than good in terms of the reality of it. I don't think that show is realistic in terms of, yes, it shows people who are depicted of having hoarding issues, but in terms of the resolution and how quick it happens... I mean, we have situations that we know of that have been going on for years and years, and it's not going to be a quick fix for that consumer.
Well, it's a learned behavior,
right,
isn't it?
Right. I mean, unless their immediate health and safety is at risk for us to have to respond to do something, you know, immediately, you know, it is going to be something that's going to be a sure. long process to try and, you know, help them get to a better place.
And I think that brings up the difference between hoarding mm-hmm. as a typical mm-hmm. someone who hoards and mm-hmm. squalor.
Yep.
I think a lot of the shows,
yep.
I mean, have squalor
yes.
with all the things that they find under their piles.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the most realistic depiction,
right.
at least in our general area.
Right. I agree.
So I guess my next question to you would be is, you see, again, you're talking about being a part of a task force. It has to be a serious issue. If, in fact, regionally, we have a task force, right?
Yes.
All right. The one thing they teach you in broadcasting, never ask a question, but they're going to give you a yes or a no.
Yes. We started the task force because we identified as a community that this issue was an issue. And not just an issue for Brockton, but an issue in the surrounding town. So we named it the Greater Brockton Area Hoarding Task Force because it doesn't just affect Brockton. You know, we were seeing cases and the same cases over and over again, and we felt like we need to educate ourselves about the different aspects of what people were seeing with hoarding, as well as how it's impacting the individual consumer. What can we do about it? How can we educate the public and educate ourselves regarding what hoarding is? Mm-hmm. So that's the bulk of why the task force was started.
And how many towns are part? How many communities? Is it a county task force, or is it just a select number of communities that have joined it or are a part of it?
It's kind of morphed into whoever is interested and wants to be a part of it can come to the task force. We're not excluding any communities, and that's one of the reasons why we called it the Greater Brockton Area Hoarding Task Force. It started with primarily being Brockton, but when we started, we had Easton involved. We've had Kingston. We've had Bridgewater. You know, again, Brockton. So it depends on who's seeing it as an issue and who wants to utilize us as a resource.
Mm-hmm. And let's say there is somebody who is listening mm-hmm. to this program and they have a concern. Give them advice right now. What should they do? They're at their wit's end and they want to do something. They want to find a happy mm-hmm. medium where they're not mm-hmm. going to hurt their loved one. But something has to be done. Kind of walk us through it.
My first answer would be call Dina. No, I'm just kidding.
Her number
and that's
is
555.
No, seriously. If you're concerned about somebody, my answer would be call us and consult about it. We would love to talk to you and figure out where we can direct you in terms of the situation. Is it something that, you know, the person may require home care services that haven't been tried yet? Or is it something more extreme that needs to go to protective services for self-neglect? Is it something that, you know, we can work with Dina in terms of the programs that she is involved with, Consumer Advocate, to help work through barriers to get in, you know, sorting and discarding and so forth for services. So every person is different, so I can't just give one answer. Mm-hmm. The common answer I can give is call us to consult, and we'll be happy to see where right. we can direct you.
Yeah, it's not one size fits all. It doesn't right. work that way.
Right.
I'll ask this again. Mm-hmm. I think I asked it earlier. What has been the most interesting thing that you have found somebody has either hoarded or collected, and you've been a part of it, you're like, oh, this is interesting. I've never seen this, where you know, you've walked in and you're trying to help remediate the situation, and you're like trying to figure out why this person is collecting these items. Nothing. There hasn't been a particular case that you've had that comes to mind that you say to yourself, wow, this was very interesting, you know, that this person was, this was what they liked to hoard and collect and pile up, and it was all over the place.
Hmm. I can't think of anything specific.
But you will in about a half an hour.
Yeah. I know.
It always happens.
It's usually been a variety. I've had people who have clothes, like I said, shoes. There's been empty containers and covers, like Cool Whip containers and so forth. brand new items because they keep on acquiring. Just everything.
Yeah, okay. I mentioned the
newspapers.
One of the ones I had was the home delivered meals containers, which were all piled up because they were nice and shiny.
I had a recent consumer who had piles and piles of newspaper in
That's
the
me.
Home.
Yeah.
because I've written for the local mm-hmm. newspaper, the Patriot mm-hmm. Ledger and the Enterprise, so I've saved my my stories.
So what I was able to do was I was able to educate him on the risk of having the newspapers in the home.
So what should I do?
Scan it.
Scan
it in.
You can scan them in and store them digitally.
I'm a hard copy recycle. Kind of a guy, though. Anybody else here a hard copy type of a person?
You could make a scrapbook.
Yep, a scrapbook.
then
you could recycle them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. You can be avalanche risk. A fall
risk.
Yeah,
they're not that high.
Fire risk.
They're no taller than Tammy. They really aren't. But I got to say, this has been a helpful segment that we have had. I hope everybody here got something out of this. I hope if we could. I know Marilyn, I got it.
We got it,
Marilyn.
We're professionals.
We get producer behind the camera, behind the radio. Phone number, website, social media, information if folks want to get more information in regards to getting to the bottom of this.
I would say call Old Colony Elder Services at 508-584-1561 and ask, you know, to speak to somebody regarding hoarding. And then it would get to us.
Absolutely.
I didn't bring my... Oh, we do have an email address, too, which
Good.
Is Brockton Area Hoarding Task Force at gmail.com. If you're not comfortable calling, we receive emails as well.
Okay, good. Ladies, I want to thank you very much. Folks, if you would, could you give them a warm round of applause for being here? Awesome. We are going to step aside, and when we come back, Casey Sherman, author extraordinaire. In just a moment, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD-FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are live here from the Kingston Council on Aging. And again, I want to thank our two guests, Terry and Dina, talking a little bit about hoarding and clearing out your clutter. I was hoping for medicine, personally. I could use it because I'm a prolific hoarder, and I have witnesses. But our next guest is a New York Times bestselling author of 10 books. I could be wrong. We'll check with him in a moment, including The Finest Hours, now a major motion picture starring Casey Affleck and Chris Pine. Don't forget the Boston Strong book, based on the new Patriots Day, starring Mark Wahlberg. Also, he's a contributing writer for Esquire, Huffington Post, Fox News, Boston Magazine. He's appeared as a guest, as an analyst for more than 100 television news programs. I'm not done yet. Oh, wait, there's more. This individual also is the author of Search for the Strangler, Animal, Bad Blood, Black Irish, Black Dragon, and the forthcoming Above and Beyond, and the Ice Bucket Challenge. Ladies and gentlemen, Casey Sherman. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Thank you, Kevin. I think I'm done, right? I mean, I think our time is up, right?
No, but it was funny because when you walked up, I go, which clone are you? Because they can't be just one of you because you do so
much.
It's fantastic to have you here, and knowing that we have you here on the cusp of a big book release, I think we probably, before we do anything, should wish your co-writer, Dave Wedge, who's celebrating a birthday on...
Turns 25 today.
Yeah, and I'm 26.
Me too.
But I have to say, it's awesome to have you here. So much that in the half-hour segment that we have you, I'm looking forward to at least gleaning from you to find out where things are at this particular point in time.
Well, you know, I mean, I love coming on the show. You guys have been incredibly supportive of my career, of my co-author Dave Wedge's career as well. We've been extremely busy over the past few years, as you can imagine. As you mentioned, Kevin, we've got a very big book that's about to launch September 5th. It's called The Ice Bucket Challenge, which really chronicles the story behind the story of Pete Frates, the young man who was at 27 years old, was stricken with ALS, given a death sentence, and literally used that death sentence to change the world. Now, I write hero stories. That's what I do. I wrote The Finest Hours, which is about four young, brave men who tackle 60 to 80-foot seas with a simple order of save as many men as you can in one of the most devastating winter storms on record. Then came Boston Strong, which is about ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances. People that when bombs go off in a crowded street, they don't run away from the smoke and the fire and the debris. They actually run toward it. Again, with that simple human natural instinct to save lives. And now we have a story of a young man at war with his own body, fighting a opponent that he can't see, that takes a little bit away from him every single day. But this is ultimately a story about love. It's a story about Pete and his wife, Julie, who at 23 years old could have walked away. She was a senior at BC when he was diagnosed with that disease. They'd only been dating for 8 months at the time. And I remember when I was first asked to meet the family, and this was right when my movie The Finest Hours was coming out. And you think I don't have time now. I didn't have any time at that point with all the different things that I had to do to promote the movie. And I told this mutual friend of ours, I said, you know, I paid $100 to ALS. I dumped the cold ice water on my head. My kids did the same. You know, it's a blessing what he's done. But I don't have time to meet this young man. And this mutual friend of ours said, Casey, you should meet him. Drive up to Beverly on a Sunday. Now, we live on the South Shore. Driving to Beverly is like driving to Texas.
Yep. It is. He's right.
On a Sunday. And he said, you know what? You are going to find one or two things. You're either going to meet an incredible family or you're going to find your next project. Well, normally I can go into a room and within 5 minutes I'll know whether or not I can write a story or a book based on the subjects that I'm talking to. Within 2 minutes, I knew. When I saw Pete, when I saw his wife, Julie, when I met his incredible family, I thought, okay, this is a story that needs to be told because of its universality, rather. You know, in a era, in a time where we really spend most of our time, or at least the media does, at tearing people apart. The government tears people down every day. This was one moment in time in 2014 where people in 150 countries around the world got together, again, for one simple reason, which was to save lives. And that was all inspired by a young man who can't talk, a young man who can barely blink his eyes, a young man who can only communicate via his heart and his brain, and that's what he does.
This is the second book that you've gotten together with Dave Wedge, because originally writing the Boston Strong book with him. What was the process like writing with Dave Wedge, who a journalist, you know, a great guy who, you know, you guys get together and you guys are doing big things.
Yeah, you know, we also just formed our first production company together called WIDA Productions, and we've got offices in Los Angeles and in Boston, and the premise there is to take our material, our books, etc., and develop them into feature films or television projects. Not only the things that we write, but stories that other people have written that we believe strongly that should, you know, have another life on the big screen or at least in television. Writing with somebody is almost like writing a song with somebody. You know, Lennon and McCartney, when they would be interviewed about how they worked together, and one would focus on lyrics, the other one would focus on harmony, etc. You know, Dave and I complement each other's skill sets very well. This is Dave's second book. This is my 10th. So, you know, I've already gone through that process of learning how to be a writer. And divorcing myself a little bit from my journalistic background, which is where Dave came from as well, and really focusing on the story itself. As someone once told Ernest Hemingway, who started his career as a reporter for the Toronto Star, Gertrude Stein, who was a mentor of Hemingway's, said, once you start not worrying about the facts, then you're going to find out what the real story is. Mm. Don't be so focused about on the who, what, where, when, and how, and why, but get underneath the surface of the story, and then the truth will ultimately reveal itself. And that's what I do as a writer.
I think it's worth asking with the folks who are here, those who are listening, those folks who may not know you. I know you're known worldwide, but I got to throw it out there to ask, what made you go from being a journalist, a TV producer, to steering into the writing direction?
Well, you know, Kevin, I call myself the accidental author. I never believed I was going to write books one day, but that is until I was thrust into the spotlight because of my work on one case, one of the biggest criminal cases in the history of American crime, the case of the Boston Strangler. Now, for me, this was a personal crusade because my aunt, 19-year-old Mary Sullivan, was the youngest and final victim in that notorious 1960s murder spree. And growing up in an Irish Catholic household on Cape Cod, my aunt's murder was never talked about until I was a teenager and I had seen the film The Boston Strangler on television starring Tony Curtis and Henry Fonda. I thought I knew the story, or at least I thought I did, and I broached the subject to my mother for the first time. My mother was 17 when her sister was murdered brutally. And I said, Mom, tell me about Mary. And she said, Casey, you know, Mary just wasn't my sister. Mary was my best friend. And my mother was going to, you know, live her life along parallel lines with her older sister. My aunt was 19, my mother was 17, so they were going to raise their families together, grow old together as sisters, and all that was stolen from my mother. And I could tell that the facade that she had put up over the years to really protect my brother and I from the truth was starting to break, and she was starting to get emotional for the first time. And as any son or daughter would, I tried to comfort her, and I said, "Mom, well, at least they got the guy." And she said, "Casey, I don't know if that's true, because no one was ever charged with any of the Boston Strangler murders in the 1960s. It was, you know, the case was left very, you know, had a lot of loose ends to it. So that became my mission in life. I went to journalism school at Boston University because I wanted to find some closure for my mother. Ended up spending 10 years reinvestigating that case, exposing a lot of new truths that hadn't been revealed before. And while I was doing it, some very high-profile writers would come up to me, Sebastian Younger, for example, who had just written The Perfect Storm, and they said, "Geez, Casey, you know, I saw you on the Today Show or some show that I was on to kind of promote the cause," and they said, "Your story's fascinating, and we want to write it." And you hear that, and you feel very flattered at first, and then I had to process that, and I said, "Wait a minute, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm living this. If anybody's going to write it, it has to be me."
Right.
And it's either going to succeed or fail on those merits. And that first book was A Rose for Mary, The Hunt for the Real Boston Strangler. It's really a memoir. Women especially are drawn to it because it's a story about sisters. I'm not the hero of that story. My mother is. My mother is the hero because she had a bond with her sister that lasted 40 years after my aunt was killed. And that bond led me to really where I am today.
We go back to talking a little bit about the Pete Frady story. I believe the governor this week, is this not Pete Frady's week?
Yes. Well, the first week in August.
In August.
Will be, you know, from today on forward, Pete Frady's week in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is an incredible thing because, again, in August 2014, Pete Frady's led a social media revolution. Yep. That raised $220 million for ALS research, which was astronomical. It's still to this day the greatest social media charity campaign in history. And before Pete Frady's came along and before the Ice Bucket Challenge was introduced, annual fundraising for ALS was about $2 to $3 million per year.
It wasn't much.
It wasn't much, which, you know, with a disease like this, because it is a niche disease, it's not lung cancer, but it is a disease that literally destroys entire families. Mm-hmm. And there's no idea of what causes it, which is why so much money was needed to do that groundbreaking research. And what is so valuable about the story of Pete and his family is the fact that that money is now being used to do that research. A year ago, scientists at UMass Medical Center in Worcester, they discovered a gene that they believe will unlock what causes ALS. And if you can find what causes ALS, then you can find a therapy to treat it.
Right.
Eventually, the hope is to obviously cure ALS, but in the meantime, they hope that ALS will be treated as a disease like Parkinson's disease, a manageable disease that allows you to live at least a semi-functional life.
Mm-hmm. September is going to be a busy month for you and Dave. We know that the book is going to be released. Is it going to be released?
Released September 5th, but it's already available for pre-order on Amazon. So if you go on to Amazon.com today, yep, you type in the Ice Bucket Challenge, or you type in my name, Casey Sherman, you can pre-order the book. And pre-orders have been already through the roof. It's already been number one on Amazon.
Wow.
For the past month. And that's a testament to that family and to the network they have. And as I said, ultimately, it's a love story. I'll give you just one little snippet, which really drew me into the story, talking to his wife, Julie, this beautiful young woman. They now have a little daughter named Lucy, who's just a miracle child in many ways. And Pete, when he was diagnosed, he already knew what he had. He had an injury to his wrist, and he was self-diagnosing, going on to WebMD, typing in his symptoms, because eventually he was having a hard time buttoning his shirts and putting on his shoes. So every time he put in those symptoms to a search engine, those three letters came back, ALS, ALS. Eventually, the doctors caught up to his own diagnosis and told him what he had. His family, mother and dad, were absolutely devastated. He had to go and tell his girlfriend, Julie, who, again, he'd only been dating for 8 months, what he had. And during that car ride over to Boston College, he's thinking in his head, well, what's she going to do? Is she going to leave? Of course she is. She's 23 years old, a senior at Boston College. You know, this is my sentence. This is my curse. This isn't hers. So when he gets to the dormitory, she sees him, and she won't get into his car until he tells her what he has. Finally, he does. She looks at him and she says, take me home. And he says, okay, I get it. You know, this is too much for you. And she said, no, Pete, you don't get it. Take me home because I'm moving all of my stuff out of my parents' house and I'm moving in with you.
Wow.
You're my life now. This isn't you. This is us. Now, that's an amazing story of true love and commitment, and I was drawn in immediately right there. I said, okay, this is the story that nobody knows about this family and about this couple, and they will.
Tammy?
I just had a question, and it kind of relates back to when you were speaking about if you wrote a story, you wanted it to be your story. I believe, just based on Facebook, that you're really involved in the movies when they're made.
Sure.
Like, is it the same thing? Like, you have someone else writing a script for your book?
Yeah, you know, your involvement with the productions is that can be, you can be heavily involved in it, or you can not be involved at all. I know writers that have sold their material to movie studios and then take the money, they run, they don't even see the films half the time. You know, I feel like I have a responsibility once it gets to that next level to make sure that the story is about as accurate as it can be and to vet the script for any, you know, gross inaccuracies that I can. And fortunately, I've been very tied in to the productions, but, you know, you still need, you want more control over your stories, which is why we started our own production company, and now we've got several different productions or stories in development, including the Ice Bucket Challenge that we're hoping to turn into a feature film, and we hope to shoot it here in New England or in Massachusetts within the next year.
What's that like having, you know, Widow Productions? And probably the question I got to ask you is it strictly just going to be producing movies or TV shows, or might you be the next Netflix?
Oh, jeez.
I'm sorry.
I haven't thought of that, Kevin, but now, you know, that's a great idea.
The streaming services.
The streaming services is the way to go. You know, I mean, it's all about opportunity, and it's all about finding a platform to tell a really compelling story, whether it's here on the radio or whether it's, you know, on a movie screen 40 feet high.
Sure.
If you can connect to an audience, that is the most magical thing in the world. When The Finest Hours came out, I had it was a roller coaster ride.
For now me. On Netflix.
Now on Netflix. So if you haven't seen it, I hope you do, because it's a really heartwarming, inspiring story. And those are the stories that I ultimately look for. I remember, and just in terms of my own journey, after writing the book, I thought for sure it would be a layup for Hollywood. Hollywood would come knocking on my door and make the film. Hollywood didn't. I had to go out to Hollywood on two occasions, pitch my story in the book to movie studios, and I was turned down every time. They said, Casey, you know, the story's incredible, but here are three reasons why it's never going to get made. One, it's a period piece. When did this take place? Oh, rescue in 1952? Well, unless that ship is called Titanic, no one's ever going to care about this. Two, it takes place on the ocean, which is incredibly costly for any studio. And three, we're Hollywood. We only make movies about superheroes. And that was, at that point, that was my counterargument to them, because I said, you're right. This is a movie about superheroes. They don't wear capes. They don't wear tights. They wear hand-me-down foul weather gear from World War II. And given a little bit of training, they can do something very extraordinary. And after being turned down after, you know, time and time again, I never gave up hope that we would make this film. And I remember walking through Times Square on business one day, and in Times Square, you've got the 40-foot billboards promoting every movie that's coming out at the time. And I sat in the middle of Times Square, and I looked up at one particular billboard, and I told myself, Finest Hours is going to be here someday. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but it's going to happen. So for the next 2 years, I had two copies of my book on me at all times, whether I was getting Dunkin' Donuts coffee or Mary Lou's or gassing up my car at the gas station. I had two copies of my book because I knew I'd meet somebody that would help me along this journey. Turns out I did.
Wow.
And fast forward to 2015, a month before the film comes out, I went down to New York with my children, and there it was in exactly the place I pictured it, a 40-foot billboard for the Finest Hours, and I wept. That was the time where it really became emotional for me, because it was about the journey, not only my journey, but the journey of the men that I wrote about, because I was very close to those heroes before they had passed on. So I felt like it was my responsibility to them to get this film made. Now, can you imagine, it's a week before New Year's Eve, and every security camera is focused on Times Square, and here's a grown man weeping in the middle of Times Square. I'm sure, New York police probably had some questions about me and about what I was doing there. But as I said, it was about the journey for me, and to be able to share that film with people in 80 countries around the world. The book just came out last week in Russia, and it's now number one in the former Soviet Union, which is bizarre to me, but take that, Putin.
I was going to say, do you think Putin bought a copy?
I think, the story of heroism is universal.
We got Gretchen at the end. Gretchen, did you have any questions at all?
You know, I was just thinking, if I were an actress or an actor, I would be waiting to see what was coming from you next. Do you have people calling you saying...
Sure.
You know,
agents calling you?
Yeah, oh yeah. Agents, actors, and you understand, the need for them to be engaging and aggressive. They want a role, so they're going to go after it, much like I went after getting that movie made. So you respect that. You don't, you can't respond to everybody's inquiry. But, you work with people that you really like. I had the great fortune of working with Casey Affleck on The Finest Hours, who I think was just transformative in that film. And he was also making Manchester by the Sea at the same time.
Academy Award winner.
Yeah, so imagine shooting for 2 weeks on the North Shore, coming down to the South Shore to do The Finest Hours and changing your entire personality to fit that role. I thought it was brilliant. I think he's, the best actor we have going right now. We've got a great relationship, and, I hope that we're going to be working again on a project very soon.
Yeah, we are speaking with Casey Sherman, award-winning journalist and best-selling author. I think I want to kind of just digress back to the Ice Bucket Challenge. Big book launch celebration, Fenway Park. Folks who want to get a signed copy, just so you know, locally, Falmouth Museum on the Green. 7 p.m.
Sure.
A discussion and signing. Yep.
And we're going to be doing also
something in Hingham.
Yep, big signing in Hingham. I think that's in that's October.
October
we're going to have
October 7th.
Thank you, Kevin. but we're going to be a full book tour beginning September 5th, the day that the book is launched. We're going to have a Pete Frates Day celebration at City Hall Plaza in Boston, really celebrating the goodness of the human spirit. After so much negativity, like I said, that we are talking about, that we're, force-fed every single day. It's always a great moment to celebrate positivity. And this is certainly a story like that. And I think we have to remember that there are more stories like that than there are the negative stories. We just have to find them and really cultivate them and share them with the world. So we're extremely... proud of that. Now, Pete Frates has gone through hell and back this summer. His death
was a rumor. Yeah,
misreported by Mike Barnacle.
Is that when you know you've made it, though?
What's that?
Is that how you know you made it?
The day that it happened, I had been very, in close contact with his family when he'd been back to the hospital, and the morning it happened. And again, Pete was, he was hanging by a thread physically for quite a while.
Wow.
And so when I got on the Facebook that morning and saw Pete Frates RIP, my heart just sank.
Yeah.
And the first thing I did is I called his mother, Nancy, left a message. I just said, I'm here. Whenever you want to reach out, I'm here. Within 2 seconds, she called me back. I was shocked because I didn't think I'd hear from her. And she said, Casey, I'm just coming back from the church. And I hear that Pete's passed away on the radio. He's not dead. You know, we just left him at the hospital. We've talked to his caregiver. He is alive. Can you get on social media and refute the story?
I remember that. I actually saw that, yeah.
Which is what we did. And, you know, I eventually, as after the, you know, craziness calmed down, I, you know, told the family, I said, well, you know, this is a blessing in disguise because, for one thing, it triggered another round of donations to ALS research. And if you want to get Pete better, piss him off. And that's what Mike Barnicle did. Pete's a natural competitor. Sure. Pete was a college athlete. And Pete, once he heard that, you know, his competitive spirit kicked in, as it always has in moments where he's been in dire stress, and he got better. And he's home today, and actually his wife tweeted out a picture of Pete wearing a T-shirt with our book cover on it, which awesome. Is amazing.
That's awesome. 50%
of the proceeds for the book all go to Pete. You know, this is a charitable effort for myself and my co-author. We were on a mission to write this book because we had to do it. We had to share it, and we had to make sure that Pete, has all the available medical equipment and care that he needs, because he is this beacon of hope, I think, for the entire world. And, you know, he fully believes that he's going to get up one day and he's going to walk his daughter Lucy on the playing fields of his youth. And, you know, people have counted out Pete so many times and he's proven them all wrong. So I would never count out Pete Frates.
I have to say, I love having you on the program on a regular basis. And we thank you. And I thank you for being a part of this program here live at the Kingston Council on Aging. We just got a couple of moments left, but could we tease folks about a couple of other things that you kind of, the irons that you have in the fire? We know that you and Dave were up working on yet another project. You were up at Gillette Stadium, kind of peeking in on Tom Brady, and another gentleman that you worked with, Mike Tugas.
Mike Tugas, yeah, who I wrote The Finest Hours with.
Above and Beyond.
We have a follow-up book called Above and Beyond, which is going to come out next winter, and that's a book about the U2 Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962. And it's a similar story in The Finest Hours in that it's a story about, you know, ordinary men with training, the pilots who are actually flying the sorties over Cuba during those intense 13 days when the U.S. and Soviet Union came closest to nuclear holocaust.
Who will blink?
Oh, exactly.
Who will blink?
And to be able to research that story and talk to many of the people who lived it. My father was a Marine in 1962. He was part of the first invasion force stationed in Miami. If we were going to invade Cuba, he was going to be one of the first boots on the ground. And
wow.
It would have been the biggest invasion since D-Day. Fortunately, we had a president in the Oval Office at the time who gave pause and who thought more than acting first. He thought first before he did that. So it's really a really powerful, strong story, and I think it really teaches us the meaning of leadership and courage and grace under fire. And you mentioned why we were at Gillette Stadium. Well, we're...
And this is because you're a Patriots fan and you like a training camp, is it?
I know. I'm a Patriots fan, but we're doing a book on the incredible 2016-17 season that began with Deflategate and ended with the greatest comeback Super Bowl win in history. And we've been spending a lot of time with Tom Brady's legal team in Washington, D.C., the men and women who defended him in a court of law, and their story is fascinating. This story is, it's not necessarily a sports story, it's more akin to Spotlight, which was the great film that exposed the the corruption in the Catholic Church. You know, this is a story that exposes the corruption in the NFL, the corruption in corporate America. If they can tear down the biggest name in their industry for one, you know, word and one word only, which is power, they can do that to anybody.
Mm.
And that's the story that we're going to tell.
Can't wait. If folks want to follow you, find out some of the stuff that you're working on, do you have a website? Do you have a way for folks?
My address is now. I would say, you know, the easiest way to get in touch with me is strictly on Facebook. Yeah. You know, Casey Sherman on Facebook, because I don't have a website, because you can't really engage with your readers that way. And I, as you know, I'm very approachable.
You are.
And I always love to hear from folks who have read my book. Sometimes they like it. Sometimes they don't.
You want to hear both.
You want to hear both, you know, as long as it's constructive and not a personal attack. I'm always willing to certainly engage, because it's my job as a writer to continue to try to get better.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again. Good luck on the book launch.
Thank you very much. September 5th,
yep.
Ice Bucket Challenge comes out nationwide. Pre-order it today on Amazon, because they will be running out within probably 24 hours of the book launch, because so many people are ordering it. Yep. But it's a love story. It's a story that, you know, everybody can read. And your children, I think, will be really fascinated by the story as well.
And not that I'm here to plug anything else for you, but you know what? Check out some of his other books, too.
Thank you.
You can find them on Amazon. They're right there.
They're right
there.
It's that
easy.
I appreciate it, Kevin.
Casey, thank you very much. Folks, round of applause for Casey Sherman here. All right, we're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk with Brian Stratton. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome opening day, Pembroke Titans softball.
Okay, Addie, you got this. Just relax.
I know, Dad.
First batter coming to the plate.
I know, Hattie, but just keep your eye on the ball. Just keep your eye on the ball.
Dad, relax. I do got this.
I know, Hattie. Remember, don't swing at the first pitch.
Daddy!
And here's the pitch. That is a fair... In fact, that's a home run!
Sorry about your windshield, Dad.
Are you kidding me? That was awesome. I'm keeping the inspection sticker for a souvenir.
Windshield broken by a home run? Call Tiny first. 1-888-64-TINYS.
That's my Hattie.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, as we are live, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, from the Kingston Council on Aging. Buddy, a nice little round of applause here. All right. All right. See, we are live here, and our final act of the evening, our final segment of the evening, as I've broken it down before in the past, I think of my program as like a meal. You know, you start out with, you know, the appetizers and you get into the entree, and usually at the end, it's like the dessert. So, Mr. Stratton, you get to be the dessert tonight.
I don't like dessert.
We have cake.
You know that. Larry, am I on?
Yeah.
If just shove cake in front of me.
I know. That's Gretchen.
Can we say hi to Derek too?
We can, but I wanted to kind of give a little bit. I wanted to give you a little bit of love first, just so folks know.
Thank you,
Brian. Our next guest, South Shore guy, who, like our previous guests, wears many, many hats. A musician, a producer, who has recorded and toured with many well-known artists. He recently enlists some of his famous friends like Jeffrey Gaines, Paula Cole, Darius Rucker, just to name a few, to donate their talents for his new charity CD called Pay It Forward, which raises money for ALS One. It's a nonprofit devoted to combating amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. As we were talking earlier with Casey Sherman, ALS, that seems to be, that's the big enemy these days that we look at, and it takes people. I mean, I think Sam Shepard today passed away from it. Not only is he a great musician, but he also is organizing this year's Scituate Heritage Days with the music lineup. It hits the stage, I believe, Saturday.
Saturday and Sunday.
Not to mention, he's the host of WATD's Friends with Benefits, which is heard on this station Wednesdays and Thursdays from 9 to 10. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brian Stratton is here. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining me. I know you're a busy guy.
Yes, these days.
I have to tell you, though, Brian, you know, I've interviewed you before. I think we chatted last year when we saw...
About a year ago, when
we saw a number of famous acts that were passing away. I think we talked a little bit about...
Our favorites were dropping left and right.
Yeah.
In early... was it 2016?
Yeah.
Early, like Glenn Frey and David Bowie. It was just... They were going down like dominoes.
Yeah.
And I mean...
Prince.
It's still... Prince. Still in 2017, it kind of backed off a little bit, yeah. But still recently, there's been quite a few. It's kind of sad because that's kind of our wheelhouse. And, you know, of course, we've got Derek Gunn here, who's...
I was just going to introduce him. Derek, of course...
Hey, Kevin.
Derek is here to kind of fill in the gaps and also provide a little percussion for us.
Add some percussion. He plays with... The Infractions. He's our percussionist.
And I have to say, I'm surprised I didn't see the Infractions on the Scituate Heritage Day lineup. Maybe next year?
Well, I felt since I was the organizer, I shouldn't probably put my own band on the first year.
Conflict of interest. I hear you.
Listen, we've waited 20 years or 25 years to get on that bill, so we can wait another year, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
As I was saying, I interviewed you a year ago, but, you know, there was that one burning question that I didn't get to ask, and I'm going to do it while I have the airtime. How did you become a musician? I mean, your bio actually professes that you were a psych student that eventually became a full-time musician. Tell us how that happened.
Well, ultimately, my father was a second-generation musician. He's gone down the male Stratton. My grandfather, full-time big band musician. Saxophone player.
Wow.
Played through the Great Depression, made a dollar a night, and said he was making, you know, a king's ransom at that point. He said musicians were very highly paid in the Great Depression. Then my father went on and played with a very popular artist named Brian Hyland. Do you know that name?
Sounds vaguely familiar, yeah.
I bet you know him, Derek?
I've heard of him, I think, yeah.
Played Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So my dad's on that original.
Rod Dwyer would know.
He's on that recording. Yes.
Okay.
So, and then as I grew up, he was molding my older brother into the music thing, and my older brother just was not getting it. But I was sitting on the sideline, being a 4 and 5 year old, kind of soaking it all in. And one day I get on the piano and started to play, and my dad's like, "Oh my God, this is the guy I should be working with." You know, I didn't do anything else right around the house, but I did that one thing right. So, thankfully, I stuck with it, and you know, it's been a gift. It's been lucky, and it's been great.
And you've also spent time producing live albums. Who are some of the folks you've had a chance to work in studio with? I'm sure there's a
lot. List. Yeah, but I'll do a little Reader's Digest version. Of course, Chicago, a ton with them, and Hootie and the Blowfish. Mm-hmm. And Siobhan Magnus from American Idol. Of course, Jeffrey Gaines and Paula Cole. Recently, John Ford Coley. From England, Dan.
Sure.
Big fan of those guys from the 70s.
You got a wow in the audience.
What's that?
You got a wow in the audience.
You got a wow? You know him? Wow,
yeah.
Yep. All right. We have somebody out there that knows. Yep. And there's a pretty good list. And Jonathan Edwards, Livingston Taylor,
sure.
Arnold McCuller. I mean, there's been a lot of greats. And it's challenging when you're the producer because you're directing famous people who have done it before. And you might have done it before, too, but they've done it more than you have. So you've got to kind of tread. You got to be diplomatic, and I think my psych background has kind of helped in those situations, being diplomatic. And you know, there's some producers that are very strict, very stern, and I'm a little bit of both. But at the same time, it's all delivery when you're in there telling them you're managing a project as a producer.
Right.
You're the manager. You're the John Farrell. you know.
I remember the first couple of times I actually saw Brian perform. One of them was for a cable show in Brockton called Another Night, but it was like Another Night, the second last show, because they had done a previous one.
What is this? Probably this was about six years ago.
Yep. Yes. And you had it was you and the Infractions,
the original guys. Yep.
And it was a small group, but when you saw them perform, I think I reached out to you. I'm like,
yes, you did.
You guys were fantastic.
Thank you.
They had done a Chicago cover, and it was
Make Me Smile. Yes,
Make Me Smile. And it, yeah. And it's funny because that's my
Larry knows that one right over there. Larry Nelson, big fan of Make Me Smile.
Well, what's funny is then I had a chance to go to the South Shore Music Circus. Of course, I was one of the folks who parked, got there early and parked in the front, because if you're somewhere in the middle, you're not getting out until about 2 o'clock in the morning, because the parking there is very interesting. But there was you know, there was this thing that they had where they called someone up, somebody who had donated a certain amount of money, and the idea was that they would get up and sing. They would sing a song. And I thought the song that – I forgot the song, but I know it was a Peter Cetera song, and it was one of those ones that you had to hit the notes. And you hit the notes. I'm like, wow, this guy's phenomenal. And then It was Brian Stratton.
Well, that was my first time I ever got to them, and then I was contacted to actually fill in dates with them. And that led to a 3-year.
You hit the notes, that's why.
No, I hit the notes. And I was thankful that Robert Lamb actually acknowledged me in front of the crowd. I was like, wow, that guy doesn't give anybody a compliment.
Right.
So for 3 years, I got to fill in with Chicago and different corporate things. And it was a good time. It was a great time. They got a permanent guy after that. But it was, you know, I certainly had a couple of dozen dates with him. It was really fun. I know.
It looks good on the resume.
It looked great. Yeah, yeah. It did. And thankfully, they had known me previously, so it was a blessing.
Let's talk a little bit about the new CD receiving its share of airplay and press. What was the defining moment that you decided to produce this CD and put it towards ALS One?
You know, once you know Kevin Gosnell, who had passed away,
I do, yeah.
And I'm so glad that you are doing the segment on ALS tonight, because I got to meet Kevin because of my talk show. And I went to his house, and I met him, and he was, you know, kind of a shell of his former self. I met him once before when he was not stricken with ALS. And this time he was in a wheelchair, and he was really battling. And it's tough to carry on a conversation with somebody who has no hope in life, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And I found that really challenging. But he was so brave at how he was trying to make things better for ALS. And so I got drawn to him, and Every week I would go over to his house and would kind of brainstorm. He asked me to be part of the board of directors. I said, sure, with ALS-1. And from there on, I was trying to figure out ways to kind of brand ALS-1. So the way we branded that was we thought through music. We thought maybe through music, maybe some famous people could get out there and reach their fan bases. And so, hence, I created a CD, which I had done in the past for Stop Hate Gun Violence, breast cancer, and some other causes.
That was our next question, Brian.
I know, you beat me. But no, I want to hear more. I went to high school with Kevin, so it's
oh,
it's
you did?
Cool
okay.
to hear this.
What a great
he
family.
Also, I just took over at the Hanover COA, and we have some of his books on sale there that also the proceeds go to ALS-1. So
really,
it's really cool to get to talk to you about it.
He was just, I mean, to see somebody in his dying days still fighting, and, you know, he knew. I mean, he would tell me, he's like, I'm not going to take the tracheotomy. I'm just going to go the way I go, which sometimes the tracheotomy, that little respirator thing, like there's a guy named Steve Sailing on the North Shore who's lived 12 years with this, but he has a ventilator. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That keeps the lungs going.
Right.
So you can live for 20 years with a ventilator, but it's really uncomfortable, very uncomfortable. And Kevin said, I don't want to live with a ventilator. So I was really just blown away by his brave, you know, outlook. And so, you know, when he passed, we just decided we're going to get guys like Darius involved and reach their fan bases. And so far, this CD has really taken off sales-wise. People in the press has been wonderful. Boston Globe, South Shore Living, and the New York Daily Post is doing something next week. So there's a lot of national papers, too. So we've been lucky.
Tim, you want to ask a question before we ask Brian to play a song?
Yeah, I was just curious. What is it like? Did you just call people up and say, hey, I want to do this CD for this purpose? Do you want to help out? Like, what is that look like?
A project like this takes a year or a year and a half to reach everybody because their schedules are all over the place. They tour, they have families. So I did make a lot of calls. 80% were on board. But, you know, when somebody's coming into town, you bring them in and they'll record with you. And that's what I did. And hopefully I tried to capitalize when they toured, like during the day, come to the studio mm-hmm. for 2 hours. We'll get something done.
Yeah.
And it worked for a while. I mean, there's still people on the list that want to do it, but we just couldn't get it together. I mean, it's, you know, probably five or six pretty well-known acts that would have done this, and they just couldn't. So, but the people that did, I'm grateful for. Yeah. And the ones that didn't, you know, maybe down the road we'll put something together with them.
I would ask you before we ask you to play a song, and that is, musicians are, when it comes to their craft and how they will like something to how they want to hear something, whether it's vocals, whether it's a drum track or they're very particular and they yes. know how they want to. How do you work with those different personalities to be able to get them all together yes. to agree and say, "Yep, this is what we want"? Because that's not an easy task.
I had a few of them almost at the verge of tears at times because I had a vision and they had a vision. And, you know, my vision was going to beat theirs because I'm doing all the work. And I'm financially subsidizing this thing. So they're, yeah. even though they donated their time, you know, the studio costs is a lot of sure. different costs. But at times, you know, I remember Paula at one time was just like, I need a 10-minute break. I need to step outside, you know. And she wasn't being mean. She was just mm-hmm. frustrated because, you know, it's tough working with and you can ask Derek here. I can be, you know, awful in those situations, just terrible.
I would say awful. It's more you know what you like and you yeah. know what's right and what's not right.
Exactly.
But that's what makes – but here's the thing that folks don't understand is that stick-to-itiveness is what creates the success.
You would hope, yes. And if your vision is really
70% of the time. Right?
If your vision is really what's ultimately right, then it should come out in the wash. But, you know, sometimes you are wrong as a producer too. Not too often, but it can happen. And then you don't feel so great about yourself. You know, but I feel like this was a good effort, this CD, and you know, it's gotten excellent reviews all over the place, and it's the best I can do. You know, it's the best I can do. I can't do any better. So I can live with it. You know, I can live with it at okay. this point.
Would you like to play us a song? What would you play us?
That's a good question. We were just talking about
Derek?
It outside.
Maybe we'll ask Derek. Derek Gunn, who's Derek accompanying. Gunn. Derek Gunn is here.
Play one of the ones you mentioned off your CD first.
All right, we'll do a little couple. Let me get the guitar.
All right, so he's getting up to get his guitar. Again, we are coming to you live from the Kingston Council on Aging, of course. We have Tammy and Gretchen who are here. They're my co-hosts for this venture. I want to thank you ladies for this fantastic evening that we have had. And I want to thank the folks who have remained behind here. Folks, let's give it up to our friend here, Brian Stratton.
Of course, the abbreviated version. Yes.
No, that's no, that's okay.
We're gonna go to a cover now.
It was like a haiku version of that song.
I have to do this one because my buddy saw that I was gonna be on the radio on Facebook. I put it out there.
Okay.
He says, "Well, you got the Bee Gees beard." He says, "I see you're covering Bee Gees songs. So when's the leisure suit coming? The Bee Gees leisure suit, whatever it is." But anyways, I'm gonna do an old early 70s Bee Gees song that, you know.
Big fan of the Bee Gees.
It's not Massachusetts either.
There's a light, a certain kind of light, never shined on me. Everybody say each and everything. What can I do if I ain't got you? Ain't got you. You don't know what it's like. You don't know what it's like to love somebody.
Gun here on Monday Night Talk. Yeah. It was fantastic. Nights on Broadway, maybe?
Probably my acoustic jive song. It's probably my favorite Bee Gees song.
I love that song.
That's a great song.
Great tune, wasn't it?
So, if folks, where can folks get this new CD, Pay It Forward?
Well, it's one retail outlet that I know locally is Mars Records in Plymouth.
Okay.
They sell the CD there. Other retail outlets, music stores, are going to pick it up in the next 2 weeks. ALS1.org, that website, you spell it ALSONE.org. You can get it there. It's $10. All goes to the research and to the good people at Mass General Hospital who have put together this amazing dream team to try to find a cure before 2020. That's really the ultimate goal for that. And, yeah, that's the place you find it. And at Scituate Heritage Days this weekend, there will be a merch booth, and it will be packed with that CD.
Really?
Along with some other CDs.
Okay.
Because there's some fine bands playing there as well.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit about Scituate Heritage Days. If folks, if you're at home and you're listening, folks who are in the audience, you want to take out your smartphone and take a look, scituatechamber.org/events. So you can kind of see the lineup, see some of the things they got in store for Saturday and Sunday. Talk to us about the lineup. You're starting at 10:30 a.m. going right to Saturday. Your last act is at 6 o'clock. Former lead singer of Journey.
Yes, Steve Augieri, who actually, when Steve Perry stepped down, he joined the band for about a decade. They did a couple albums. He sounds identical to Steve Perry.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm sure Larry can concur with that one. He sounds as good. If their current guy is Arnell, the Korean gentleman. This guy, Steve, was just blew my mind when I heard him, and I see YouTube clips all the time. So I decided to hire him, and he's going to perform Journey classics all through the night for 2 hours. And you'll close your eyes and you think you're listening to Steve Perry.
Okay.
It's amazing. And if you're a big Journey fan, which you got to like them, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got to respect them.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
How can you not, right?
Absolutely. I like the bands. I mean, again, you stepped in. You're a change of direction.
I'm a newbie.
Newbie, sure. Taking over, organizing. Yes. What's it been like for you? How busy have you been? And what's it been like to kind of...
The busy factor is off the charts. I mean, this is besides, I do other festivals. I do the Hingham Shipyard every Friday night.
Oh, yeah.
I do some Marshville Fair stuff for concerts there. I do all over the place, down the Cape. So it's been a busy season. But this one particular one is really revered in that town. Like, I mean, the last 2 months, it's like you go into the library, you go wherever you go. They want to know what's going on. They'll stop you in the middle of the street. You know, you go to Starbucks or wherever you go, Dunkin' Donuts, they'll ask you about, hey, what's going on with Heritage Days? So there's a lot of pressure that goes along with it.
But, right.
As long as this thing materializes the way I hope it does, we should be in good shape.
Okay.
I went a different direction because the former musical director was basically geared toward a lot of the older classics like the Stompers, the Fools, John Butcher Axis, Danny Klein's Jay Giles tribute.
Sure.
A lot of that kind of stuff, and he did it in and out. No local bands really ever got a shot there, so I decided to give a lot of those Scituate local bands their first try because they've all been knocking on the door for several years and not getting a chance. So this year we have like five Scituate local bands early on, and as it goes through, there's some more experienced bands as the day goes on.
Sure.
Yes.
I'll throw in a plug, Southbound, Divas with a Twist.
Okay.
Some very talented young ladies.
Well, you've seen that before?
I have.
All right, I'm glad. That's one I did not pick, so I don't know what I'm getting into there.
The Doc Ellis Band, another great band.
They're great.
Yeah,
Doc Ellis is very good.
Yeah. And that's Saturday.
By the way, Southbound, and if you haven't seen them, that's that band's led by John Finn. And you know John Finn, obviously. Mm. Boston Pops, their guitar player. And Jeff Navarez. Those are just a couple of the best electric guitar players you'll see anywhere.
Mm.
I mean.
See, a lot of tough choices.
We haven't
even talked about Sunday yet.
No. And there's a lot of, you're right, there's a lot of tough choices. And you have, 12 positions to fill in 2 days. So many people have wanted to play that festival for decades. They just never got a sniff at it. So now they're getting the chance, and I'll continue to do that in the next few years.
Okay. Yeah. You just got a couple of moments left here. Anything else you want to say regarding this? And do you want to take us out with a song, maybe?
Okay. We got Brian Howe is Sunday night from Bad Company.
Yeah, that's why I was...
So we got to talk about that one quickly.
Let's do it.
It's Sunday night.
Is that Derek's favorite act?
Out of that night, that would
probably... Okay.
Yeah, Brian Howe was... he replaced Paul Rogers in the late 80s, and Bad Company had a second wave of success. And they had some top 10 hits with Brian Howe for 10 years, and he's coming, and he's going to sing the old Bad Company and the more recent Bad Company. So it's going to be amazing. That's Sunday night, 4:30.
And what are you doing throughout all this? Are you just making sure that the bands are transitioning on and off stage? Because
all of that.
Okay.
I'm going to help the sound people. I'll be helping the equipment people, of security, just all of anything that has to do with that stage area. And it'll be, as long as the weather works out and the sound works out, I think it'll be a great weekend.
Do you want to quickly tease this week's Friends with Benefits? You got anything special planned?
Well, yes. Wednesday night we have Steve Auscieri from Journey and Brian Howe from Bad Company.
Oh, you couldn't have gone for tonight?
The same night. No kidding. Huh? I whipped that one. We have them both on Wednesday night.
Yeah, you do fantastic. I've heard some of your interviews with some musicians.
Thank you so much.
You do a great job.
We've had a lucky string of some great names, just like you on this show. So, it'll be great. We're looking forward to it.
All right. Take us out with a song.
What do we got, Kevin?
Again, we've had as our guest here, Brian Stratton. You've been listening to Monday Night Talk.
I went down to Reno, I was say about 29. Didn't get to sleep that night till morning came around. And then I'm going to tell my time friend to the dearest friend of mine. Just might get some sleep tonight. night. Went down to the levee, the devil met me there. Took my $20 bill, vanished into air. Ain't gonna take my time, friend, the devil is a friend of mine. I get on before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. I went down to the levee, but the devil met me there. Took my $20 bill and vanished in the air. Said, ain't really gonna take my time, friend, the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep.